And now on to the business of the High Court. Yesterday, the Supreme Court kicked off a new term with a docket full of controversial cases. Today, hearings begin in Kimbrough versus the U.S. That case has sparked a fresh debate over the fairness of drug sentencing laws. Joining me now to talk about the case is Deborah Small. She's executive director of Break the Chains, a group that advocates for drug policy reform. We're also joined by Eric Sterling. He's president of the Criminal Justice Policy Foundation. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
So, Deborah, why don't you give us a little background? Who is Derek Kimbrough? What are the basics of the case?
Well, Derek Kimbrough is a man who had been a Desert Storm veteran, who had a good employment history, who unfortunately came back from the war and found himself caught up in drugs. He was arrested and with a fair amount of drugs on him, both powder cocaine and crack cocaine, and he also was in possession of a gun. He actually pled guilty and admitted responsibility, and as a result of that was faced with federal sentencing under the federal guidelines. The judge in his case looked at the guidelines, looked at the amount of drugs involved, and also looked at the Supreme Court's direction from the decision that they made in 2005, Booker Fanfan, and taking into account his background, as well as what the guidelines said would be a reasonable sentence for him, sentenced him to 15 years. The Justice Department lawyers argued that he should get 19 and a half to 22 years because he possessed a certain amount of crack cocaine. The fact is that he actually had more powder cocaine than he had crack cocaine, but because of the 100-to-1 sentencing disparity, applying that amount of crack would have upped his sentence by about 4.5 to 7 years. The judge thought that that was ridiculous and refused to impose the higher sentence. And that decision was appealed by the Justice Department, and that's the issue that the Supreme Court is looking at today, whether or not it's reasonable for judges to consider the fairness of the crack powder sentencing disparity when rendering sentence in a case like this.
Now, Eric, you were counsel to the U.S. House Committee on the Judiciary. You were involved in the passage of these mandatory minimum laws. What were they meant to do when they started, and have people's opinions of them changed over time?
They were meant, in one sense, to encourage the Justice Department to focus on the highest level traffickers and the most important cases. In another sense, they were meant to be politically advantageous to members of Congress who were facing an important election battle in November 1986. The Democrats very much wanted to inoculate themselves against charges that they were soft on drugs and crime. The mandatory minimums were a way to look tough and to try to convince the electorate that they were as tough as the Republicans. And so there's a battle back and forth in which the trigger quantities of drugs went down and the length of the sentences went up as it went from the Democrat-controlled House of Representatives to the Republican-controlled Senate. What we've found once the law took effect in October 1986 was that the Justice Department applied these cases overwhelmingly to low-level offenders, overwhelmingly African Americans. For every white person prosecuted for the crack cases, for every white person, 10 black people get the same kind of prosecution, and they're almost exclusively low-level offenders. So the law is being misused. The Sentencing Commission has repeatedly looked at the way in which the law has been applied and criticized it, and we're now at in the most recent situation, the crack cocaine penalties are going to go down as of November 1st under the sentencing guidelines, and there is legislation pending in the House and Senate that may begin to reform this.
Now, Deborah, this is far from over, but this has gone back and forth in the courts, both the legal courts and the courts of public opinion. If this case changes policy, what will happen in a material way to people who are small-time dealers or small-time users?
Well, it's interesting because I think one of the things that's really important about this case is that even if the Supreme Court renders a decision that we think is just, which is to say that judges can consider the guidelines in imposing sentences consistent with their ruling in Booker Fanfan 2005, it's still not going to change the fact that African-American defendants who make up over 80% of all the federal crack prosecutions are still going to be facing extremely long sentences compared to people who are being prosecuted for powder offenses. And so until we get legislative action to change this disparity, there's still going to be a huge amount of racial disparity in the federal sentencing system driven primarily by this law. And one of the things I think is really important to look at is that a lot of the outrage that had people travel from all over the country to Jenna, Louisiana a week or so ago was this growing frustration that communities of color feel all over the country of being unfairly treated and disproportionately punished by a criminal justice system that's supposed to be fair but is anything but.
Now, Eric, is there support for this among judges, support for a reform or a change in mandatory minimum sentencing?
Yes, I think there's strong support among judges. They are terribly concerned about being asked to enforce what they think are unjust sentences in these cases. They've been surveyed by the Sentencing Commission, and judges would like to see more power returned to them to mete out what they think would be fair sentences. You know, last week, the federal prison population exceeded 200,000 for the first time in history. When these laws passed, the federal prison population was 37,000. This enormous growth in imprisonment around these cases, I think, disturbs judges and disturbs most people who pay close attention to these matters.
Deborah, finally, I have met people in the course of my reporting who say, you know what, and these are black people, these laws are racist, but I can't afford to have dealers near my son, my daughter. What do you say to that?
Well, you know, I live in a community that has a fair amount of drugs. I live in Harlem, and I know that a lot of people feel that way. And yet when you ask them whether or not you think the law should be applied equally to blacks and whites who engage in the same behavior, they overwhelmingly say yes. And so the issue is not whether or not people should be punished for dealing drugs, but whether or not we should have laws that punish people more severely for dealing one form of the same drug as they do for a different form of the same drug. It's as if we had a law that punished people 100 times more for selling scotch as opposed to selling beer.
The other important point here is that we're talking about the federal government, which can deal with the international level cases. Local crack dealers are the responsibility of state and local law enforcement. They have enormous capacity to do it. When the feds do neighborhood cases, they're not doing international cases, and the cocaine can keep flowing into the country and keep every crack house in America supplied.
And I think it's important to note that even though the federal crack sentencing disparity has been in place for over 20 years, very few states have chosen to adopt it, which tells us that they think that the tools that they have in the current law are sufficient to mete out punishment for this. And one of the really bad things about the way the law has been applied is that it encourages people to federalize cases so that should stay on the state level that they can impose stronger sentences on African American defendants.
Well, Deborah and Eric, we have to end there. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Deborah Small is the executive director of Break the Change, and Eric Sterling is president of the Criminal Justice Policy Foundation. They both joined me from our NPR studios in Washington.